Mormon Stories Podcast is a production of the Open Stories Foundation. All donations to Mormon Stories are fully tax deductible and go directly towards keeping the podcast alive and towards building a community of support for Mormons like you. To support the podcast or to join the community, please become a monthly subscriber today at mormonstories.org. Hello and welcome to another edition of Mormon Stories Podcast. I'm your host, John DeLynn. And today I am very, very excited to have with us a very special guest. His name is Dr. Michael Coe, and the subject for today is sort of an outsider's view of Book of Mormon archaeology. Very fascinating. Let me give a quick introduction of Dr. Coe. He is the Charles J. McCurdy Professor Emeritus of Anthropology at Yale University and Curator Emeritus of the Division of Anthropology at the school's Peabody Museum of Natural History. He is an expert on the Maya, who inhabited the same part of Mexico and Central America where Mormon scholars say the events, where some Mormon scholars say the events of the Book of Mormon took place. In this interview, Coe discusses the challenges facing Mormon archaeologists attempting to prove the historical truth of their central scripture and his own views of Joseph Smith. I'm now reading from the biography from a PBS documentary in which Dr. Coe was featured. But with that, I guess I'll just say, Dr. Coe, thank you so much for joining us on Mormon Stories today.
I'm happy to be here.
All right. So I guess I stumbled upon your interview with PBS just on Facebook. Someone had posted a link to it, and I read it, and I said, wow, this is a Yale anthropologist who cares about Mormonism, and I found that to be fascinating. And so I did a little more investigation of you and found out that you published an article on the Book of Mormon and archaeology as early as 1973, I believe you said. Is that right?
That's correct.
Yeah. And so so this is, you know, this is interesting because the Book of Mormon is in, you know, in the year 2011, coming under a lot of scrutiny that I guess it's been under a lot of scrutiny for some time, but that scrutiny hasn't really penetrated the traditional, you know, Orthodox conservative or, you know, kind of, I guess I should just not be repetitive, the traditional Mormon consciousness until, let's just say, the past 5 years, as DNA evidence and other things have really started people, Mormons, thinking more clearly about what the Book of Mormon claims to be, what type of record and evidence it purports versus the evidence that science continually affords us. And so I thought it'd be fascinating to bring you on and talk all about, you know, your life and how it intersects with Mormonism and what you know about the Book of Mormon and Mayan archaeology. How's that sound?
That sounds good.
Okay. And I should add that I served an LDS mission in Guatemala. And so I've spent a little bit of
That's
time.
That's excellent.
Yeah. So I've spent a little bit of time in the area that you're in, which you're a specialist. So so let's start in typical Mormon Stories fashion, Dr. Coe. And please tell us a bit about your early years, your upbringing. If religion and specifically reconciliation of religion with intellectual issues was a part of your formative years, I'd be curious just to have you talk briefly about that. And then we'll jump into how your training led you to be interested in Mormonism and the Book of Mormon.
Well, I was I was born in 1929 to a very devout Episcopalian, or rather Anglican, family. My parents were, you know, strong churchgoers. My father had been to a church school, a boarding school in New England called St. Paul's. And I was raised, I went to Sunday school when I was a little kid, raised with the Bible, with Christianity, right from the very beginning. And St. Paul's was a church school. It really, the head of the church, of the school, was the rector, was a reverend, Episcopalian minister. That's not true now, but it was back then, a whole series of them. And you had very serious study of Christianity there. Not only did you go to chapel every day, that you were there, twice on Sundays, 3 hours on Good Friday minimum.
Holy moly.
But you had literally, you had something called sacred studies, which was a course that you took, and all we had forms rather than grades, and every form you had sacred studies. And I must say, I rather enjoyed it all. It's fascinating. The Anglican Church has a marvelous tradition, and it was fun reading the King James Bible. I suspect during my years there, I read the Bible twice, which is more than I can say that a lot of
the whole Bible,
the entire thing.
Oh my goodness!
Beginning to end. So, and of course, with emphasis on the New Testament. And I was confirmed at the age of 13 in the Episcopalian Church by the Bishop of New Hampshire, which is where that church was. We had a retreat. I was very religious, I think, up to this point.
Were you a believer? Did you kind of believe
of course,
the whole story?
Yeah. Of course, absolutely. And because I'll say one thing. The Episcopalian Church and its Anglican background, they got some of the best music in the world. And it was an aesthetic, you know, very satisfying experience as well as a religious one. So during sacred studies, in my last year there, my sacred studies teacher in that particular class, who was a minister, tried to give us the reasons for the existence of God, 10 of them, that
10 reasons.
St. Thomas Aquinas came up with. How can you prove the existence of God?
Right.
And suddenly it hit me, one of the reasons that was given by St. Thomas Aquinas, was that this world exists, therefore it had to have a beginning and therefore a creator.
Right.
I stuck my hand up in class. Suddenly it hit me. I said, what if the world is eternal? That is, if there's eternal in the past and eternal in the future. And the guy was stumped. That was a stupid, silly child's question, but one that I thought was important. You know, maybe the world is eternal. There's
sure.
no beginning, and therefore probably no end.
Right.
And he couldn't answer it. And suddenly things started to slip away from me. by this time, I was already, I think, 16 or 17, my last year before I went to college. And I discovered an amazing book by a wonderful English anthropologist named Fraser, called The Golden Bough, which is sort of a popular introduction to anthropology and all about it. And suddenly everything slipped away from me completely.
Like what?
I lost all my belief in religion, although I still kept a real interest in it.
What about the book made you lose your belief in religion?
Fraser went through, the guy had an encyclopedic knowledge. He's one of the founders of anthropology in the 19th century, and went through and showed, for instance, all the things we take for granted, like celebrating Christmas, things of that sort, and the sacrifice of a figure like Christ, for instance. He's found in many, many other cultures through history. He was a classical scholar and could go back and in the Greek and Roman classics, and he knew all about Africa, all about different places. It seems that he put it all in perspective, that this is a religion is a man-made construct to answer certain important questions, not something that comes down from on high. And from then on, I suppose it got me started on trying to find out scientifically what religion really means to a people. Why is it religion? And, of course, there are many, many answers, because religion is many, many things to many people. But at any rate, I started to become a skeptic then, and I'm still a skeptic now, absolutely. So that was my background in being interested in religion. Of course, about Mormonism, I knew very, very little. An uncle of mine in Wyoming, where my grandfather had a nice place, told me to go, if you want to read something interesting. We had an Encyclopedia Britannica there on the ranch. Now go look up Mormonism and you'll find it fascinating. And there was a wonderful article on Mormonism in one early edition of the Encyclopedia Britannica. And I think got my interest in Mormonism started back then as an amazing phenomenon in the history of religions and in the history of America. So I always was interested in this subject. When I went to Harvard as a graduate student, although I eventually had to leave because of the Korean War, I was taking a seminar there with some really hotshot graduate students who were way ahead of me in anthropology. And walking back at night to the place where I lived with one of the students there, who we got started to talk about Mormonism for some strange reason. Turned out he was a Romney. And A. Kimball Romney, descendant of presidents of the church and, you know, cousins of all the famous Romneys. Huh. And a direct descendant of George Romney, the portrait painter, English portrait painter.
Wow.
And we started to talk about this. And he, again, was he had his career as a Mormon had followed my career as an Episcopalian, the same kind of a thing. He discovered anthropology and was no longer, you know, let's say a true believer.
Right.
So we talked a lot about this. I learned things about the Mormons that I never, ever knew, such as garments. I'd never heard of garments.
Right.
This was, to me, amazing. I mean, it just all these fascinating things. And I loved to talk to him about this. He's an extremely distinguished anthropologist in this field now. With the Smithsonian for years. But at any rate, that also sparked my interest. And even before that, as an undergraduate, once I got into anthropology, I'd taken a great course on the anthropology of religions by one of my professors, Evan, E-V-O-N, Vogt, V-O-G-T, who was born and raised in Mormon country in the Southwest, but was not him. His family were not Mormons, but he had deep interest in Mormonism. And he had a guest lecturer named, I think it's Thomas O'Day,
mm-hmm.
who wrote a standard book on the Mormon religion, a Catholic anthropologist writing this. And he gave a lecture on Mormonism, which just held me spellbound, such as, for instance, the whole concept of a that you know that as God once was, man now is, as
right.
As God now is, man may become.
Right.
He went into that, and it fascinated me absolutely. I never became a Mormon, obviously, but I really got to through him to respect this whole thing, not as a weird phenomenon of crazy polygamists, but as something really serious, worthy of study. Now, I never really deeply studied this, except when I was asked to write this article for Dialogue magazine back in 1973, Journal of Mormon Thought.
Mm-hmm.
And I did a lot of research at that point to write that article and found out things that I never knew about, you know, the background of Smith and Book of Mormon archaeology and all the rest of it. So I've always been. And then, of course, later on, I really got to know a whole lot of Mormon archaeologists, both in the field and at BYU and elsewhere. So, yes, I've always been sort of connected with this.
Okay. And just really quickly, I read your bio, but tell us how you're trained in ways that it relates to how you might know a thing or two about the scientific record versus kind of what the Book of Mormon might be claiming.
Well, of course, anthropology has various subfields in it, and one of which was is archaeology, the past, the study of the past, and that's what I was from the beginning, an archaeologist.
Okay,
and I had the good luck in my sophomore year at Harvard to visit the Maya area, just as a tourist.
Mm-hmm.
I went to Yucatan over Christmas holiday and to Chichen Itza, which is a famous site. It's quite a late site in central Yucatan. and great, a beautiful, wonderful place. I came back. I was flabbergasted by it. So I discovered that to really get into this seriously, there wasn't any major in Maya archaeology when I got back. I was in English literature until then. I couldn't change to Maya archaeology. I found out that if I wanted to do this, I had to take anthropology. Mm-hmm. And that was my introduction to anthropology as a field. But right from the beginning, I was hooked on Mexican, Central American archaeology, and in particular the Maya. Mm-hmm. And that, of course, leads directly into Book of Mormon archaeology. It's the same area, and I can talk something about this, the same time period involved, supposedly. So I've always had that connection. I took 3 years off during the war to do other things during the Korean War, which I can't tell too much about, right. And then got back to Harvard as a serious graduate student in what we call Mesoamerican archaeology. That's Mexico and Central America, the past. We call that whole area Mesoamerica, and I'll be using that term later on. It's basically the area of Mexico and Central America, countries like Guatemala, Honduras, Belize, etc., that had high civilization at the time of the Spanish conquest.
Okay.
So northern Mexico is not part of it, but the rest of it is, in southern Mexico. So it's Mesoamerica that claimed me.
Gotcha. So you're tell me if I got this right. You're an anthropologist broadly, an archaeologist sort of specifically, and you focus on Mesoamerica.
Right on.
Okay.
That's it.
Okay. And you, were a professor at Yale for?
I taught at the University of Tennessee for 2 years.
Volunteers.
Frantically writing my PhD, thesis, which I got accepted by Harvard, and eventually was invited up to Yale, and I spent about 35 years here at Yale.
Okay. All right.
I'm now retired. I was retired in 1995, but I still write books. Still write about the Maya, and I have other interests too that I've written about, but mainly Mesoamerica.
Okay, gotcha. All right, well, good. So I guess let's jump right in to what your understanding is of what the Book of Mormon claims from an archaeological, geographical, historical perspective.
Well, the Book of Mormon, of course, like the Old Testament, has a migration or a series of migration legends in it. And it involves people crossing, whole oceans, not just crossing the Red Sea, but crossing the Atlantic, mm-hmm. Out of what today we would call the Middle East, the Near East, the Holy Land, to what Smith claimed to be a land that he eventually, the land Zarahemla, to be somewhere down towards Central America. So this is what it's about. Now, there were actually two big migrations in the Book of Mormon. There are. The first of which were the Jaredites. And these people came across, but they didn't really survive terribly long. The great migration was, of course, the Nephites, who were highly civilized people. You know, they had the compass to navigate by. They had iron. They had cattle. They had horses. They had wheat. All the things that they had at that point in the Middle East, of course. And none of which, or almost none of which, were ever found in Mesoamerica. But Joseph Smith would not have known about that, but he went ahead and described this mighty civilization with people who built these huge temples and so forth. And then, of course, as you know, if you follow the Book of Mormon, that there were a kind of a heretical group sprang up of discontents, malcontents, called the Lamanites. And the Lamanites eventually won out and destroyed the Nephite civilizations and killed all the Nephites and basically took over. And according to Mormon Book of Mormon archaeologists, and according to the faithful, why, who are the Lamanites? Well, they're still there. They're the American Indians. And as Smith or somebody said, that if they play their cards right, these pathetic Lamanites, these awful Lamanites, they'll become white once more. White and delightsome, I think, is the term. They'll become white men and white women and white children.
Right.
So basically, that's my whole migration thing, and that's the whole business about Book of Mormon archaeology. To find Zarahemla, to find the plates of gold that were inscribed at the last trump, so to speak, that were shown miraculously to Joseph Smith, that he supposedly translated as the Book of Mormon. That's the background of Book of Mormon archaeology. And this kind of thing has been going on for a long time, Book of Mormon archaeology.
Right.
Especially at BYU, although it's basically not practiced now, but it was back then at the beginning. And I got to know the people involved with this.
So we'll talk a bit about the specifics of the discrepancies, and then we'll talk about your experiences with the archaeologists and what they were trying to do. Does that make sense?
Yeah, that's
okay.
Fine.
Okay, so according to what the Book of Mormon, and let's go into a little bit more detail about what the Book of Mormon would lead us to expect to find archaeologically, geographically, anthropologically, if the Book of Mormon historical record were accurate, what would we have expected to find? And let me just maybe give a little bit of a disclaimer. You know, I think Hugh Nibley, at some point, I'm sure you're familiar with Hugh Nibley.
I never met him, but I certainly know who the name Hugh Nibley, all right.
Right. So one of the defenses that I think he would have made at some point is that with jungles and with weather and with temperature, you know, lots of things can be destroyed and eroded. Bones, books, records, weapons, you know, who knows what can be rusted and deteriorated over time, you know, when you're talking about 1,000, 2,000 years, maybe even, 2,400 years. And so, you know, let's just assume at the beginning that we're going to account for reasonably, sort of plausibly deniable, apologetic responses that are reasonable. Given that, what would we expect from the Book of Mormon text to find if the Book of Mormon text were an historical document?
Well, Hugh Nibley is wrong about the idea that this stuff is, you know, all of it has disappeared forever. Take iron, for instance. Nobody ever used iron in the New World, per se.
Does the Book of Mormon claim iron or does it claim steel? I know it claims steel.
Well, call it steel.
Okay.
I mean, iron is a principal component of steel.
And I think there are steel swords mentioned in the Book of Mormon, or shields or helmets or whatever.
That's correct.
Okay.
You would expect, you know, with all this mayhem taking place, let's say, with the Nephites fighting the Lamanites, you'd expect to find that stuff. Archaeology relies on a host now of physical and chemical methods of detection that we didn't even know about a lot of this stuff, say, 50 years ago when I first got into archaeology, that are now available now. And these things don't disappear forever. They leave traces. If you had iron or steel, you would expect to find these things, even if they were all rusted, you'd still find them. You'd find the chemical remains. They've never been found, ever. Take wheat now. Wheat, they claim that the Book of Mormon archaeologists claim, well, the wheat's going to disappear. It's organic and so forth. Well, if wheat were grown, it would have to pollinate. Like all grasses, it's a grass, it would have wind-blown pollen. Hundreds of tests have been made in lakes and other places in Mesoamerica, coring, going down through the sediments. Nobody has ever found, prior to the arrival of the Spaniards, any indication that wheat was grown. The pollen is distinct in all of these plants. Maize pollen, for instance, shows up naturally all through the thing. There's no maize, by the way, isn't really mentioned in the Book of Mormon.
Dr. Coe, just going back to metal for a second, I seem to recall that the Book of Mormon mentions brass, iron, copper, gold, silver, coins, and steel swords. So does any of that...
Let's do the coins.
Okay.
Nobody has ever found pre-Columbian coinage, ever.
Okay.
Anywhere in the New World, Mesoamerica, or Peru, or Wisconsin, any place.
Okay.
It's never been found in pre-Spanish times. Coinage. Coinage was brought by the Spaniards first to the New World.
Okay.
So that there's one that you can discount right away as proof for the correctness.
And you think those things could survive in the dirt?
They certainly would. They certainly would. Coinage is, this is the whole idea behind coinage is that it's common, commerce is conducted with it. You certainly would have found it. The only real coinage, in quotes, that they ever had in Mesoamerica was cacao, chocolate beans, which did serve as small change, had value, the chocolate bean, dried chocolate beans. That's exactly, if there were coins, there'd be chocolate beans. Why aren't chocolate beans mentioned in the Book of Mormon?
Right. I've never thought about that. What isn't mentioned in the Book of Mormon, like corn and chocolate?
Now, copper alloys like brass. Copper in any form doesn't show up in Mesoamerica, although it's very ancient in its use in the Andes and the Peruvian area. Doesn't show up in Mesoamerica until at the earliest 800 AD.
Oh, okay.
Period. The same way is in Mesoamerica that gold doesn't show up in any way until 700 or 800 AD. Period. There's none. Although these things existed in the Andes, it isn't until people brought them up, probably by sea trade, early on that you'd ever find anything like that.
And the Book of Mormon record ends somewhere when? Like 300 or 400?
The whole idea of Book of Mormon chronology is, I think this has all been worked out by Book of Mormon archaeologists, the Jaredites are the first. And they go back, to something like 400 or 500 B.C. That would put them scientifically, if they existed, as Olmecs. Now, that's one of my specialties, is the Olmec civilization of Mexico. I've excavated a very, very big and the oldest Olmec site. I can assure you that everything we found there is Native American. Everything.
Meaning what? Meaning
it's got a tradition of these people are eating maize, they're growing maize, they're using chocolate. We just found that out, they were drinking chocolate there. All sorts of things that are typically American, nothing to do with the Middle East at all. Mm-hmm. These are amazing people who could make absolutely huge monuments of basalt, of volcanic rock, carve them as colossal heads. They're amazing in their own right. There are many questions still about the Olmec to be answered. But we know that they're very ancient. They go back to, the Olmecs were there from probably about 1400 B.C. Until about 400 B.C. So they're pre-Lamanite. And it's already an advanced civilization. And you can check with one famous Mormon archaeologist about this, my friend John Clark, those are the dates, because he's had a lot to do with this whole business. Mm-hmm. They don't check in with the Book of Mormon, with Jaredites bringing the, you know, civilization over from the Middle East. There's nothing in the slightest bit Middle East about the Olmec.
Okay.
Not at all. So you've got crops mentioned in the Book of Mormon that never existed in pre-Columbian America.
And barley and wheat and...
Exactly. Never has there been any... All of these things would have produced pollen if they'd been grown by anybody. Mm-hmm. And a lot of this stuff is windblown. It would fall onto ponds and lakes and get enclosed in sediments. And tremendous amounts of pollen work has been done in this area, in Mesoamerica. Very interesting, because it shows climate differences and the arrival of maize, corn cultivation, and things like that.
So you're finding ancient pollen. You're not finding ancient barley or wheat pollen.
Doing this kind of work for, you know, 50, 75 years, drilling down into lake beds. And yes, we find ancient pollen, and there's none of this stuff that's in the Book of Mormon. It does not exist, period.
Okay, what about things like silk, chariots, swords?
Okay. Silk, nothing. Now, that silk, of course, is highly organic, but there was never any production of silk in the New World prior, well, probably till the colonial Spaniards brought it across eventually. You know, it's silk was invented in Asia, in the Far East, not in the Near East. And there's no silk whatsoever, no idea of silk cultivation. No conquistador mentioned silkworms eating mulberry leaves or anything like that, which you need for the production of silk. So silk wasn't there. What else do we have now besides that?
Seven-day calendar?
Seven-day calendar was unknown in Mesoamerica. Our seven-day calendar was totally unknown. They had a completely different calendar that operated on different principles. They had a 260-day calendar that saw the permutation of the number of 13 numbers with 20 day names. Hmm. And these produce see, 13 and 20 have no common denominator. They produce a 260-day calendar. Every 13 days, the same number will repeat again. That would make a week, but it would be a 13-day week. Or the 20-day cycle would produce a 20-day week. 7-day week, totally unknown.
Okay.
The names associated with the 7 days, which are all, you know, planets, the sun and the moon and so forth with us, that was unknown in Mesoamerica.
Okay, no evidence of that. What about, like, war stuff, like chariots and helmets and swords and shields and stuff like that?
Right. Well, they had helmets, all right, but they weren't made out of brass, that's for sure. And they used them in the bowl game and probably in kind of something that resembled jousting, where they fought each other with special stones that they held in their hands and tried to smash each other's heads. This game is still being played in West Mexico, incidentally. Mm-hmm. Highly dangerous. Ugh. These guys were sort of like gladiators. They probably wore padded wooden helmets, probably with leather over them for this. We have actual, in Oaxaca and even in the Maya area, some scenes that show this. Chariots, they never had chariots, so that is for sure.
What about wheels?
Well, they had the wheel, but because they hardly ever used it. There are wheel toys known in classic times, that is, you know, probably from about 400 or 500 A.D. on, in Veracruz on the Gulf Coast of Mexico, there are wheeled clay toys, and they probably had a very simple potter's wheel, which was still in use in Yucatan through the conquest period. But for transportation, they had the backs of people. All records that we have show that enormous amounts of goods passed or people passed on foot, and stuff was carried on people's backs with a tump line that went around the forehead and connected to these big packs. And it was highly efficient. By the time the Spaniards got there, all the battles were fought on foot by native troops against the Spaniards. There were no chariots there whatsoever. And there have never been any remains of chariots, never any remains of the wheels of chariots. You'd expect to find these things eventually. There are places where preservation does happen.
Okay.
And nothing after 100 years of archaeology, zero.
Okay, let's do animals. So the Book of Mormon mentions horses, cattle, oxen, donkeys, goats, sheep, swine, and elephants.
Okay, let's
and,
go.
Oh, and curlums and kumamums. Sorry.
Let's get the horses out of the way first. The horse was not domesticated. The horse evolved in the New World. The whole evolution of the horse took place in the Americas, and during the height of the Ice Age, I guess.
Oh, so you mean like tens of thousands or
tens of thousands of years, hundreds of thousands of years ago?
Okay,
and the horse crossed over into the Old World across the Bering Straits during a period when the ice, there was a lot of ice, and the water level dropped and revealed dry land as a land bridge into Asia. This is something the Book of Mormon archaeologists don't really like to talk about, but yes, this was a huge way of animals crossing back and forth between the Old and New World. So when the first American Indian ancestors arrived, probably certainly by 15,000 years ago, probably as long ago as 20,000 years ago, there were plenty of horses in the New World. But very shortly, in the space of, let's say, 5,000 or 10,000 years, they had wiped them all out, every single one. The horse was extinct probably by 7,000 BC. The horses were gone, along with many of the other large animals. There was human overkill. They came in, it was happy hunting grounds, and horses were food in those days, as they had been to our European ancestors back in the Paleolithic. So they wiped them out very quickly. The horses disappeared from the New World by 7,000 BC. There's no evidence for horses whatsoever in any archaeological site ever. Until the Spaniards arrived with horses. And, of course, their horses became feral. A lot of them ran out onto the Great Plains, and the Great Plains Indians got them, became the greatest cavalrymen who ever lived. We think of Indians and horses together, but that's late.
So it would have made sense for Joseph Smith to associate horses with Indians because...
Yeah, right. Yeah, he sees them incredible people like the Comanche and the Sioux and Cheyenne and people like that, unbelievable, ferocious horsemen. I mean, like the horse and the animal was one thing. They were the greatest horsemen who ever lived. But that probably would have influenced him a lot. He had to have horses. But, of course, you've got horses in the Old World, in the Bible, in the Holy Land.
And he might have even associated the crops that we talked about and coins with Indians because maybe, the Spaniards would have brought them over?
It took a long time. Coinage probably wouldn't have been among the Indians for a long time, actually. But they eventually got it, particularly down in the southwest in the Pueblos after the Spaniards took them over. Spaniards were eventually kicked out down there in 1691, I think it was. But they had already introduced the horse. Wheat, certainly, to the Pueblos. The Pueblos were growing wheat eventually, but only introduced by the Spaniards there.
Okay.
So so the horses, there's no question about the horse. That's late. That comes in with the Spaniards.
Okay. What about the others?
So let's remind me. What
cattle,
are the, cattle,
oxen,
okay.
Donkeys, goats.
Okay, cattle and oxen are the same thing. They're all genus Bos taurus in the Latin name. Definitely Old World. No evidence whatsoever for any kind of cattle of any sort, whether oxen or what have you, in the New World prior to the time of the Spaniards. The Spaniards brought those in. Donkeys, the same thing again. No wild asses or donkeys have ever been found in the New World. They were evolved in the Old World and came in with the Spaniards, or if they had existed before, they were reintroduced by the Spaniards. Absolutely no bones of these creatures ever showed up. Pig, zero. Not one pig bone has ever shown up in pre-Columbian excavations. And I can tell you that huge amounts of excavations all through the New World have been made over the last 100 years.
And they do find animals. Do they find ancient animals?
Oh, lots of animals.
Okay, what do they find?
You find wild animals, deer, for instance, dogs were in the New World and were eaten by almost all the American Indian groups. I've dug up Olmec kitchen mittens, you know, the old Olmec garbage down in Mexico, just full of dog bones and whatnot.
So animal bones can survive 2,000, 3,000 years.
Oh, no question about it. They're highly impervious to disappearing. Turkeys. Lots of turkey bones eventually, especially in classic times, once you get into the classic civilizations like the Maya one. Muscovy duck, which is the New World duck, definitely show up. Hmm. And then many, many wild animals, deer,
tapirs?
Down in South America.
How about tapirs?
Relatives of the camel. How about what?
Tapirs.
Tapirs, yeah. But tapirs, they were formidable animals, and they generally used tapirs for their hide, which was they could make armor out of it. So heavy and thick. But yes, tapir bones do show up in these things. All of us who do these excavations have saved all the animal bones. They've all been carefully identified by competent zoologists who have comparative collections, and there's no question. None of those things mentioned by Smith in the Book of Mormon are in pre-Columbian or pre-Spanish archaeological sites from 10,000 BC. I mean, there's absolutely nothing.
And let's do elephants real quick.
Elephants, there's nothing. Absolutely zero.
You're not giving us much to go on here, Dr. Koh.
No, I'm sorry. this is zero. I would, you know, back in Smith's day, let's say 1835 or 30s, or back in those days, 20s and 30s, these things just weren't known. Nobody had ever dug an archaeological site except to loot it for gold or something like that. Nobody knew any of this stuff. We have enormous amounts of information now about all of this, just vast, vast quantities. Hmm. So basically, if you're looking for old world connections and looking at the Near East, you're looking in the wrong place. That's another topic, because I'm not saying that there was never any contact between the Old World and the New World in pre-Columbian times, because I'm sure there was. But none of it looks like it comes out of the Middle East in the form of Jaredites, Nephites, or Lamanites, or what have you.
Yeah, so that's an interesting point. I think I recall... And for my listeners, a lot of this information I'm getting from my questions comes from a website called MormonThink.com. It's an excellent website which lists a lot of this stuff. But it mentions something about some type of painting or drawing on a cup or some type of material that has an elephant, an Indian elephant roaming a city that might be dated to kind of the 600 to 900 AD time period.
Well, that 600 to 900 AD would be late classic Maya. There's a lot of painted pottery. I mean, we now know from excavations, but principally in museums and private collections, we've got a record of over 6,000 Maya vases. There's a website devoted to them, a wonderful website. My friend, the photographer and archaeologist Justin Kerr, has rolled these things out photographically, available to everybody. So we know what they cover. And I have never seen on any of this stuff convincing elephants. There used to be a British anatomist, Sir Elliot Grafton Smith, back in the beginning of the 20th century in England, who wrote a book called Elephants and Ethnologists, in which he claimed that some of the monuments, the stone stelae, these standing dated stone monuments at the site of Copan in the western part of Honduras in Central America, that what's shown on the top of one of those are elephants with the mahout, the guy running the elephant, Indian style, on top, sitting on top of his back of his ears. Mm-hmm. Well, we now know that those things are not elephants. They're rather Baroque macaws, which is a very large parrot with a huge beak. Mm-hmm. And in fact, the hieroglyphs that go with it tell us that we can now read, tell us that those are in fact macaws up there. Mm-hmm. They're not elephants.
Gotcha. There were no elephants. Like them, they kind of look like them, right?
There were elephants in the New World back in the Pleistocene, in the Ice Age, definitely. There are wonderful elephant kill sites that the Clovis people, the people who made these beautiful fluted points at about 10,000 B.C., that they slaughtered these animals. But they killed them all. All the elephants were killed off by the end of the Ice Age. They're all gone. There's none. And
do we have digs from before the Ice Age?
For humans
that we've found or anything?
No. I mean, when you get back beyond the Ice Age, you're back beyond the Pleistocene. You're in the Tertiary period, the Pliocene, and there were no humans in the New World at that point. They arrive at the end of the Pleistocene or the Ice Age, across from Asia, from northeastern Asia. All of us who are scientific archaeologists think that the evidence is conclusive. That was never a barrier at any point, to tell you the truth. It's a highway into the New World, and we now know that they had boats. Boats are very, very ancient in the world, much mm-hmm. more ancient than we ever thought. And then the reasons for thinking this, and people would have had boats would have come down the Pacific coast, all the way to the Pacific coast of South America in boats, establishing colonies on the way. Shortly after their arrival, when they saw all these amazing, this megafauna, they like to call it, these huge animals roaming the landscape, including elephants, they wiped them out. It was overkill. There are also, people claim there are environmental reasons for this, climate change and whatnot. That probably entered into it. But the main reason, most of us think, was humans slaughtered them.
Gotcha.
Overkill, just wiped them out.
Okay.
And you don't have any elephants until God knows when. Who brought the first elephant over after the Spanish conquest? I mean, it wasn't P.T. Barnum.
Right.
somebody brought it across to establish zoos.
All right. So so let's turn a little bit now to language and culture. What language do we think that people in Jerusalem, Laman or Lemuel or Nephi or Lehi, what language do we think they would have spoken in 600 B.C. coming out of Jerusalem?
Well, they would have spoken a Semitic language. I mean, they would have spoken, the literate of them probably knew Babylonian, Old Babylonian.
Okay.
They some of them probably would have, been literate in Assyrian. I don't know how far back Aramaic goes. But that was the language of Jesus at the time when he lived. Jesus almost certainly spoke Aramaic. That was the kind of everyday language that people spoke at that point. But all of these languages there that they would have spoken, except possibly some people who knew Old Persian, which is an Indo-European language, they would have spoken Semitic languages.
And what about people who would have been descendants of the 12 tribes of Israel and Abraham and all that? Jews.
They would have spoken, they would have spoken one of the other Semitic language.
Hebrew?
Hebrew was becoming a literate language rather than a spoken language at that point. But the literate among them would have certainly have spoken, Hebrew as a scholarly and sacred language. But the everyday language was Aramaic. And, so you want to know is there any evidence for these languages the pre-Spanish New World?
What would a linguist tell you is realistic Because languages, I guess, can die all the time. And so, and they can get subsumed and combined. And so, you know, I guess apologists now are okay, so here's, I'm going to go back for our listeners and just restate kind of my understanding of what the deal is. It, it seems to me like the Book of Mormon pretty early claimed to be a historical record of the ancient American inhabitants. And whoever wrote the titles, the title of the Book of Mormon, you know, clearly tied Native Americans to the Book of Mormon. And then, you know, Joseph Smith himself, you know, would walk around and see a pile of bones and say that was the famous Nephite warrior, you know, Zelph or whatever. He would see a city and say this was the ancient city of blah, blah, blah. So it's pretty clear that Joseph Smith tied Native Americans to the Book of Mormon. Now, what apologists are saying now is that even though Joseph Smith may have got it wrong, there's nothing in the Book of Mormon that precludes the possibility of other peoples living in ancient America prior to the arrival of the Jaredites or prior to the arrival of you know, Nephi and Laman and Lemuel and Lehi. And so it's very possible that they lived in these small little colonies or cities, but that they also had interactions with existing civilizations such that it's very easy for not only their language and not only their culture, but also their DNA to ultimately be subsumed or enveloped and eventually erased by these other larger existing cultures. Now, if you believe that latter theory, then you have to say that Joseph Smith didn't understand the Book of Mormon or didn't get it right, that he made a lot of errors. And you also have to assume that pretty much all the church leaders from then to now who would travel to Latin America and call descendants of, call Native Americans and the descendants of Native Americans who would call them Lamanites, and they do. I mean, in Guatemala, the Guatemalan members of the church there would call themselves Lamanites, and they would do that because Spencer B. Kimball, one of our former prophets, and others would go down there and call them Lamanites too. And so there's this a bit of a pickle where there's going to be a problem either way. Either Joseph and all the prophets from Joseph to now, or most of them, pretty much all got it wrong, calling people Lamanites who they shouldn't have called Lamanites, or we should have to think about what's realistic to expect for a potentially existing culture to then envelop and subsume another one. So talk about that if you can.
Well, let's talk about the evidence for language in, let's say, the Maya area. You know, when Joseph Smith read the great two-volume work that came out by John Lloyd Stephens with his artist Frederick Catherwood, travels in Central America, Yucatan, etc.
How do we know Joseph would have read this book?
He did read it because it was one of the most popular travel books ever published in the United States or anywhere else. It was a wild hit, huge edition. Everybody had copies of it. And I have read, I hope it's true, that when Smith read this, which was the first really solid account of the Maya ruins by a marvelous writer and a wonderful artist that was accurate, he said, that's it. Those are the Nephite cities. If the Nephite cities, you take the Nephite cities, were Maya, therefore classic Maya, because the civilization, pretty much classic civilization, disintegrated by 900 AD, you would have to say, what language did they speak? Were these people, they would be one of those enclaves that you're talking about, and these highly civilized people. And every time you look at, say, the illustrations in the popular edition of the Book of Mormon, you see that's a Maya city because there are Maya temples, Maya pyramids, and people dressed as Mayas. So let's say they're classic Maya. What language did the classic Maya speak? Now, it used to be that you could play around with that, you know, and say, well, we can't really read the hieroglyphs except for the, you know, the dates and the calendrical stuff and whatnot. That's not true now. We can read almost everything. We can read 95% of what follows the dates on these inscribed monuments. We can read 95% of what the Maya themselves wrote. And what language is this in? It's in Maya. Not only Maya, there are 29 extant Maya languages, which are all closely related to each other, but all somewhat mutually unintelligible. It's like we speak English, but our language is related to German, to Dutch, to the Scandinavian languages, you know, mutually unintelligible when we speak them, but they were all one at one point. There are now 29 Maya languages. Which particular of those languages is being reflected in the hieroglyphs? Now, since because of the great decipherment, which has taken place in the last 20 or 25 years, we can read those. And they are all in one particular ancestral Maya language, which we call Choltian. Now, the guy, one of the two main people who discovered, I think conclusively, what this language is, happens to be a professor at Brigham Young University, John Robertson, a good friend of mine, fantastically good linguist. It's all of the inscriptions now, we know from all through Guatemala, all the way up to the northernmost part of Yucatan, Belize, Honduras, and so forth, southeastern Mexico, they're all in this literary language, which was a special language. And that the only language that's close to it now among these Maya languages is Chorti, which is spoken on by a small group of people on the border between Guatemala and Honduras. If you drive from Guatemala City to the ruins of Copan, you go right through Chorti country. This is a language that was spoken by their ancestors that became the literary language. Now, like Hebrew is the literary language of the Bible, of the ancient Bible, like Sanskrit is the language of the Hindu religion, like Latin is the language of the Roman Church, the Catholic Church, or what used to be the Western Church, a prestige language that was understood by everybody, and it was a literary language. It's in Maya. It's not in Aramaic. It's not Semitic. There are no Semitic words whatsoever in it. It's got no relation whatsoever with any languages that we know of in the old world. It's strictly Mesoamerican. And right from the beginning, they were starting to write about 400 BC. We've got some evidence for that, right until the Spanish priests wiped it out and burned all their books. That's what the language is, and there's nothing old world about it.
It's no characters, no references.
We can read all these hieroglyphs.
What do they say? What do they talk about?
Now, the monuments, of course, are public monuments. Most of their books, except for four extant ones, are missing. The monuments mainly talk about the dynasties. They're all about the people who ran these city-states. They were all city-states, the royal marriages, births, marriages, conquests, royal deaths, rituals that they performed at important times. That has to do with their conquests.
And is it stuff happening? Do we have writings between 600 BC and 300, 400 AD?
Oh, yes. We certainly do.
Talk about a King Benjamin, or do they talk about an Alma and a reign of the judges?
Let's say go BC. There are some writings. We know they were already starting to write that. They're very hard to interpret, but there's nothing in them other than a Mesoamerican explanation for them. There are no King Benjamins or anybody like that. The Olmec, for instance, who Book of Mormon archaeologists say were Jaredites, we had no writing whatsoever for the Olmec. None. Zero. Which is peculiar if these people came from the Middle East, where writing goes back to at least, 2800 BC or earlier. We have nothing from them, except that not so long ago, a tablet was found. I call it that because that's what it looked like. And it's inscribed with hieroglyphs that are all Olmec, but we can't read them.
Okay.
We call that the Kaskahal block. It was I published it along with a whole bunch of other people who are interested in this whole thing, and it's probably about 900 or 800 BC, the date of it. But this is the only Olmec writing we have, and we can't read this. Unfortunately, there's not enough to crack. We have about beginning about 200 AD, we start getting extensive Maya inscriptions.
Okay.
And they're in Maya, and they can be read in Maya.
And do they mention a Mormon or a Moroni?
They don't mention any of these wonderful people out of the Book of Mormon. Nothing. Zero.
Okay.
They're all Maya. Every single one of them.
Okay. All right.
So the language of these people who Smith was talking about was Maya.
Thank you for joining us today on Mormon Stories. Music today was provided by the Saber Rattlers. Check them out at saber-rattlers.com. The Mormon Stories logo was generously donated by StudioCase.com. Thanks for listening.
Come, come, ye saints. No toil nor labor fear, but with joy wend your way. Though hard to you this journey may appear, grace shall be as your day. 'Tis better far to drive to the sand joy. Your hearts will swell. Oh, all is well. All is well. Why should we mourn? I think our lot is hard. 'Tis not so. journey's through.